Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Confluence Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. Joining me today, as always, is Mark Keller, CEO and CIO of Confluence. We're recording this podcast on October 28th. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate the question and answer sessions of the A.G. Edwards Investment Strategy Committee's open mic sessions from earlier this century. To submit questions, email us at mailbag@confluenceim.com. Each month, we'll select four or five of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions we receive. Mark and I will address them. So without much further ado, let's go ahead and tackle the first one. So, clearly, China is gaining ground on its ability to have an impact on U.S. markets. The purchase of zero soybeans this year is putting farmers in a tough spot. And with their cuts in available supply of rare earths, is there a point where Xi says, I'm more in control here and you need to make a deal with me? Would the current administration say, yes, let's make a deal or source the materials from somewhere else at potentially higher costs? Well, the question gets to two key points. The first is, who has escalation dominance? If you're not familiar with Substack, it's a forum for writers and analysts and others. It's sort of a thinking man's alternative to Twitter these days. And one of the more famous names on there is a fellow named Doomberg, otherwise affectionately known as the Green Chicken. And he recently had a discussion about the whole notion of escalation dominance. And what escalation dominance means is that if you're going to start a fight, who ends up with the upper hand? And the United States, with most countries, has clear escalation dominance. There's a lot of countries in the world where a U.S. military base sits on its land. Losing that base would expose that country to all sorts of bad things. And thus, when the U.S. says they want something, they tend to get it. China is not in that situation. Now, it doesn't mean that the U.S. doesn't have cards to play with China, but China can clearly push back. And I don't know, from my perspective, I view China and the U.S. kind of at an equal level in terms of escalation dominance. Although China can restrict rare earths and losing the sale of soybeans is a problem for U.S. farmers, access to chips is really important, and the U.S. does have an alliance network that China clearly does not. So in terms of escalation dominance, I tend to view it as a draw. How do you view it, Mark?
Yeah, I see it the same way. And I think in this regard, Trump's usual negotiating pattern has not worked. But what do I mean by that? His usual negotiating pattern, I kind of refer to as the Missouri mule approach, where you hit him between the eyes with a 2x4. You get his attention and you get him to do what you want. And what Trump usually does is he hits really hard with kind of a maximum force, and then he backs off from there and say, here, okay, you know, gets your attention and then backs off. And we've seen this coming out with big 50% tariffs on some people. And we've seen him do this a lot of other things. And then he settles into something a little more reasonable after his opponent is fearful. That just doesn't work real well when there's this kind of balance. Because he really came out with his best shot. I mean, what is his best shot? His best shot is withholding the U.S. consumer from Chinese exporters. And he doesn't have a lot to play after that. And I think what China had a lot of cards to play yet, and they've begun playing them. And I really think that, you know, with respect to this major power, it's not worked well. And I think that he's going to have to back off somewhat. They're going to have to cut some sort of a deal. But it's not going to be as good a deal as he's going to get with other countries.
The second element, of course, in this battle really comes down to which society can bear the most pain. And generally, the thought is that China, because of its political system, no elections, single-party system, has a lot more ability to endure pain. Whereas the U.S., because it's democratic and we go to the polls every 2 years, the ability to endure pain is limited. And I think that's generally correct, with one caveat. Authoritarian systems tend to be able to endure pain until they reach some sort of breakpoint, and then suddenly it's over.
Mm-hmm.
Nicolae Ceaușescu in Romania is probably the most cogent example of a guy who was completely in charge, and 6 days later he's hanging by his neck from the grounds of the Imperial Palace. The issue, of course, is that pressure point or that break point is completely unknown and always surprises when it happens. But you know, the whole pain endurance thing is probably the other critical level of this. And the perceptions of each leader of how much pain their societies will mm-hmm. endure, I think, is important.
I agree, by the way. I think Ceaușescu was shot by firing squad.
Was he?
Oh. Yeah, we got a pretty erudite audience here, and I think they would correct you on that.
Well,
I've
been wrong before, just as my wife. So,
But you're absolutely right. Authoritarian regimes look pretty solid until they're not, and then they're gone. And, you know, we think, you know, American presidents and key members of Congress worry a lot about their power. Fact is, they're nowhere near as paranoid as authoritarian regimes are. They worry about losing power pretty regularly. And the fall of the Soviet Union is still a hot topic in power circles of Beijing. They want to make absolutely sure that never happens to them. But yeah, their legitimacy is always in question in those. But I think generally, yes, they can, in this regard, tolerate more pain than the U.S. leadership can. It's just...
It's not infinite.
It's not infinite. In our lifetimes, we've seen a lot of authoritarian regimes fall. And most of them, like Ceaușescu, looked pretty solid until the end.
You know, and I've listened to a number of podcasts on this and read some papers on it, and people have tried to divine, well, what was the one thing that happened that made it clear this thing was done? And you know what? That's doing history backwards. At the time those events occurred, nobody thought they mattered all that much. You know, there was a minor religious protest in one part of Romania that seemed to not get quashed, but, you know, again... I've concluded that you can never tell when an authoritarian regime is going to fall apart. And when it does, when it falls, the collapse is shockingly quick.
Yeah, I got a stack of books at home on the fall of the Soviet Union, and they don't agree.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put it this way.
Yeah, no, that's right.
You don't know. You have indicators. You know, there's been a lot of bubble talk lately. Same thing.
Yeah.
You know, you have a powerful bull market, a boom in an industry. You think it's transitioning to a bubble. You're convinced it's there. What's going to stop it? No one knows. 20 years later, people still don't know.
No, that's right. Question number two. If we have a recession, how long and deep would it be? On its face, this is the kind of question that, like, no one knows. But we wouldn't have selected it if we didn't want to expound upon it. When I started studying economics in ancient times, early to mid-80s, recessions were treated sort of as natural occurrences. There was a whole Keynesian idea that we can mitigate them or maybe postpone them, but recessions were kind of viewed like rainfall. You know, they're going to occur, and they're a natural occurrence. And what we've kind of discovered over the past couple of decades is that fiscal and monetary authorities can take aggressive steps and pretty much prevent recessions. And if one occurs, they can take aggressive steps to ensure that it doesn't last very long. And your primary example of this was the COVID recession. It was really deep. It lasted 2 months. You know, in fact, there's some debate among economists that do business cycle analysis as to whether or not it was actually a recession because it was so short. It got marked as a recession because the employment rate rose dramatically. But, you know, in terms of time, it didn't meet the standard. The previous one was, you know, of course, the great financial crisis. But I would remind readers or listeners that recession officially started in December of 2007. And Mark and I were both there, and there was a raging debate at the time as to whether or not we were in recession. You know, it reminds me of that scene in Groundhog Day where the guy drives off the cliff and crashes into the bottom of a pit, and the gal asks, well, you think he's okay? And he goes, yeah, he might be. And then the car explodes. He goes, no, he's not good. Well, Lehman Brothers was kind of the car exploding in that example. And everybody knew then, of course, oh my God, yeah, obviously we're in a recession. Policymakers have gotten really good at providing support to the economy, and the Fed has expanded its toolbox to the point where it backstops virtually every asset. In fact, we could argue that it can put a floor in under any financial asset that it chooses. So if we have a recession, to some extent, it's a choice, and its depth is also a choice. And in fact, what we're wrestling with now is, well, what's a world like without recessions? It's a little bit like, what's Christianity like without hell?
Well, let's not go there.
A good thing to avoid.
We only have a one-hour podcast here. You know, a lot of those choices were unintentional, but they were a consequence of the fact that we had a gold standard or a semi-gold standard where, up until 1971, whereby we had a very inflexible money supply. And the result was, when that's a given, you know, you're going to have kind of a boom and bust cycle. And even after that, for, you know, or almost a decade, the Fed only had one real mandate, and that was to control inflation. And even after they added the unemployment mandate, and that is to keep it down, you know, it took a while before that really became a serious thing. You know, certainly during the Volcker years, inflation, fighting inflation was it. And pull out again my favorite Thomas Sowell quote: in public policy, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. And our trade-off was we wanted to keep inflation low and make U.S. Treasuries valuable reserve assets. And that meant, you know, some eggs had to break somewhere else. And now we seem to want to keep recessions from happening at all. And there's going to be trade-offs. We certainly saw the trade-off after the extraordinary action during the COVID recession. We had a surge of inflation, not all due to money policy and Fed policy, but a lot due to it. And there may be other trade-offs that we don't know about yet. We're both kind of in the camp that deglobalization will be more than likely inflationary. And if they really don't want recessions to ever happen again, there's going to be some trade-offs of probably higher inflation, probably some other stuff we haven't even thought of yet.
Well, one of the things that I've been bulling about is that, you know, recessions correct asset prices, and it punishes those who misallocate capital. Well, if you never have a recession and you never punish the misallocation of capital, not only do markets always go up, but, you know, the whole buy the dip mentality goes on steroids, and 5% corrections become, you know, special events on CNBC, and the market just never goes down. And so its usefulness as an investment allocation facility really goes in the tank, and everything becomes investable.
And you have the Minsky problem.
Yes.
Then, right? And in fact, that's been kind of my long-term view of it. I certainly didn't invent it, but I've ascribed to it, and that is that boom times, growth times between recessions are periods that tend toward malinvestment the longer they go. And the longer the Fed takes action to postpone recession, the worse the malinvestment gets. And recessions then are definitionally, I don't know, maybe I'm making up a word there.
Yeah. But it's a good word.
It's a good word. I'm going to have to work on it. What recessions, therefore, are periods where the malinvestment is cleansed from the system, mm-hmm. which means the people who made the malinvestment lose their money.
Yes.
And assets, usually they lose it because the malinvestment involves too much debt, and the assets have to be liquidated and move into stronger hands. And you know, the problems develop politically when that malinvestment throws too many people out of work, and or in, as we saw in 08, involves malinvestment in residential real estate, and people actually lose their houses directly, not because they've been thrown out of work. So it's a, anyway, getting back to the original question, is this going to be a bad recession or not? I don't know that we're going to have one. But if we do, I don't see a lot of malinvestment on the consumer debt side. There's some evidence of it in car loans, in used car loans in particular. I really don't see it in the housing market, which is the most important consumer debt area where there could be malinvestment. It looks like the other place there's malinvestment going on tends to be in equities right now. It's very similar to the late 90s when equity malinvestment goes bad, it tends to be rich people that lose the money. And as we saw in the recession 2001 and 2, it wasn't that deep because it's usually equity money that's lost, not lenders are not wiped out. So my knees aren't knocking together in fear of the next recession, even though none of them are pleasant.
No, they're not pleasant. But in some respects, the question reflects a fear. To me, the bigger concern is that we don't have one. That, you know, it's hard to know what valuation of equity should be if you never have recessions. You know, I mean, there's really nothing other than extreme valuation that drives down the price. I mean, one of the things you see in recessions most of the time is that you see big drops in earnings. It's especially true of operating earnings because they tend to get massaged, and there's a come to Jesus moment when a recession occurs because it gives CEOs permission to kind of clean up whatever things they've put into their operating earnings. And once you get that process done, then you start anew. And if you never do that, it's hard to know how high is high.
If you ask me where I see the worst malinvestment going on right now, it's probably in AI investment. It's, you know, we're spending $1 trillion.
Yeah.
It's the majority of total capital spending in the U.S. right now. I'm no expert on AI for certain, but I'm guessing a lot of that is going to prove to be bad investment. And when people realize that and corporate CEOs start to say, hey, what are we doing here? They cut back. And you end up with layoffs and write-offs. It's not pleasant. I don't know if the Fed can do anything about it, but I don't know that they need to. It's because, again, we're probably talking about rich people getting hurt.
Well, I guess what I would tell the questioner is that there's obviously something out there that can cause one. We worry about that less. There's other things we worry about a lot more. Question number three. I was wondering if you guys had given an outlook or opinion on the upcoming Supreme Court meetings on November 5th to the legality of Trump's tariffs. Seems like it could be a big deal. What do you think?
Yes, it is a big deal.
Okay, next question.
In the future, don't send in a question that can be answered with a yes or a no. Yeah,
that's right.
No. But no, we will elaborate. Yes, it is a big deal. I have, you know, as Bill knows, I don't write a lot, unlike Bill. But I do give a fair number of public talks, and I've been saying since early summer, I thought these tariffs are probably illegal. That's because they are issued under an act called the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, or IEPA. It kind of rolls off the tongue. IEPA is a law that has been on the books for several decades and gives the president all kinds of economic powers when he declares an emergency. And the powers are enumerated. Most of them are sanctions. None of them are tariffs. Tariffs are not enumerated. There is some reference to what an emergency is, but it's very vague. And so what, you know, people ask, you know, we've never had this kind of tariff before where the president can move the dial around, you know, at will during the day and whenever he wants. And that's because he has claimed that the economic emergency is many years of trade deficits, trade imbalances, and that he is empowered to do this. You know, again, you know, I am not a lawyer. I do have 1 year of law school, which is better than spending the night in a Holiday Inn Express, but is not exactly make me an expert. But I have read a lot of legal opinions and a lot of laws over the years, just part of the job. And I think it is probably not legal under IEPA and therefore would be unconstitutional because the president has power over tariffs only because Congress has given it to him, if they've given it to him. So if it's not given to him, et cetera. Okay, the Court of International Trade ruled 3-0 against the administration in May, said you don't have the power. That got appealed up to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which ruled 7-4 against him. The 7 in favor had all different reasons for it. The 4 dissenters were very clear that they thought the act did give him powers. IEPA. A number of legal analysts have said those 4 dissenters are ideologically more in line with the court's current ideological slant. So the ever-present betting markets think it's about 60-40 that it gets overturned, but it isn't a sure thing. But if it does, there's a whole lot of things that happen. Number one, the question is, will they rule immediately that he has to stop collecting tariffs? Number two, will they say you've got to give the money back and now? In which case, you know, goodness gracious, we've got like $100 billion. That's a lot of refunds.
Yep.
Number three, it would be, is there any alternatives? And there's quite a few alternatives that he has. And I know you've done some work on that. Maybe I'll pass the ball to you.
Well, you've got the Section 203 tariffs, which tend to be sectorial, but if you massage them long enough, you get to a lot of places. The difficulty with all the other alternatives is that there's procedures involved. And you have to do studies, and it's hard to just get mad at a country and say, you know, we're going to slap you with X percent tariff because you did something that we didn't like. Now, it's not that presidents don't do that sort of thing. It's just that previous presidents have used sanctions for that, which they have been given pretty broad ability to inflict. Tariffs are a twist on this. I guess my own opinion on this, just looking at the Supreme Court, is I think they're probably going to signal this is okay. But it's a tough call because within the Supreme Court, there's a fair number of smaller government types that would like to take away broad federal powers in general, and thus granting this one could be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, we'll know a lot more on after November 5th when there's oral arguments. It's a Wednesday next week, and they don't always tip their hands, but the questions usually indicate where they're leaning. I think it's a tough one for the center of the court, who Roberts is the key player there, of course, because they've made the major questions doctrine really important in all their decisions. That is, if it's a major question and it has broad impact on the economy, the mandate from Congress has to be clear. And if they're going to rule this is okay, they're going to have to somehow say that Congress was clear, even though they didn't mention tariffs. It'll be really interesting. But the bottom line is there'll still be tariffs after this.
That's
right. It's just going to take – Trump won't have the flexibility to kind of move the dial as he wants. Some of these tariffs require studies of competitive situations that can take anywhere from a month to 3 months. Some of them have limits on how big the tariffs can be. Some of these other laws say that after 150 days, the tariffs expire. So he's going to lose a lot of flexibility to do what he wants on here if they rule against him. I think that 60-40 bet is about right. I think odds slimly favor them ruling them, you know, illegal or unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't shock me at all for them to go the other way. So that's why I always dislike investing strictly on a court decision. You just never know. It's even worse than investing based on what you think Congress is going to do.
No, that's right. Well, and this is one of the underlying problems that we have in this country is Congress writes bad laws because they know they can rely on the courts to then interpret them. And then, of course, they complain that, well, they interpret them in ways that we didn't like. There's an easy fix to that. Write good laws.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to write good laws because when you write good laws, it clearly delineates who wins and who loses.
Yeah.
And we're in a democracy.
Yeah, people who have to get reelected every 2 years don't want to be that clear on who's going to lose. And they would much rather write bad laws that must be interpreted and implemented by the executive branch and let them worry about it.
That's right.
So there's a fair amount of laziness in this as well. That way I can say, hey, we wrote this law. Don't ask me exactly what it says, but I'll tell you all the good stuff. And then the president has to do all the bad stuff, you know, and that's why we have all these interpretational problems.
Sure. Well, that's right. Got one more question here, but it's a good one. Gold prices have fallen dramatically in the past week or so. I know you guys have been bullish. Any thoughts on gold? Why don't you start off with this one?
Well, okie doke. Well, we're off a little more than 10%, I think, from our highs. Or around, as we do this, I didn't check it just before.
3,900.
Was it 3,900? Okay. Yeah. I we're a little closer to 4,000, but that's okay. 3,900. I want to get out my handy dandy little Bloomberg on my phone. But the issue here is that about 3 months ago, it was around 3,400. So we're still up rather dramatically from where we were. You could almost see the point in time when speculation took over. if you pull out a gold chart or a chart of any gold, and by the way, here you are, well, we're both kind of right. We're at 3958 as we sit here. Okay. So right between. Around August 22nd, thereabouts, all of a sudden, gold, which was in a nice steady uptrend, just kind of like went
parabolic.
Yeah, like they put it like a rocket on a launch pad, just went up. And it went up 25 to 30%. Depending on what day you pick, but 25 to 30% in about 2 months. That's a big move in any market, much less a global market like gold. At that point in time, I started saying, yeah, we're going to, from some point on this parabolic move, we're going to get a sell-off, and we're getting it. And my own view is, and I was saying it even before, in fact, I was giving talks on the road 2 weeks ago, and I was saying, listen, a pullback into the mid-3000s wouldn't shock me at all. And I think the uptrend is still in place as a result. And I don't say that as a technician, but as someone who believes that what's going on, the gold market is fundamental. Fundamental strong bull markets do have periods when participants get overly excited, and you know we've seen that in the technology sector many times. We've seen it in gold before, and I think you know the underlying fundamentals are still in place. That is the value of gold as a reserve asset for central banks worldwide has increased dramatically over the last 4 years, and I don't see that going away. And the dollar has weakened as a result. And, you know, after I think about a 14-year bull market in the dollar, it sure looks like the dollar's entering a bear phase here. And that's good for gold too. But yeah, I think we're probably likely to see a sell-off and then some sideways action for a while before it resumes.
That's kind of my view too. In modeling gold for years, you could use, you know, real U.S. interest rates, dollars exchange rate. That all worked pretty well. When the central banks started expanding their balance sheets, throwing that variable in gave you a lot of explanatory power. The latest sea change was twofold. One was the freezing of Russia's foreign reserves after they invaded Ukraine. And the other has been central bank buying, but primarily Chinese central bank buying. And then recently, Chinese central bank buying appears to have stopped, but it doesn't look like it stopped Chinese buying in general at all. And there's some speculation. Brad Setzer's probably the best source on this, but he's been making the argument that if you correctly account for China's foreign reserves, it's probably closer to $5 trillion than $3 trillion. And they're surreptitiously holding those reserves in the banking system, which is state-controlled. So it's not state-owned, but state-controlled. And so a lot of that gold is ending up there. You know, when the U.S. froze Russia's reserves, it sent a tremor through the reserve management community that, you know, unless you were confident that you were going to stay on side with whatever U.S. administration comes into power, you were at risk that this could happen to you too. And, you know, once you use these aggressive tools, the temptation to use them again increases because you've kind of crossed a Rubicon, so to speak. And so central banks have been steadily diversifying their gold versus treasury holdings. You know, Mark and I are old enough to remember in the late 90s that central banks were chastised for holding any gold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now they're being chastised for not holding enough of it. So conditions do change. You know, there was, in the late 90s, there was a very high degree of confidence that the dollar treasury reserve system, reserve currency reserve asset system was in place and would never be threatened. And of course, that has broken down. And so China has also wisely figured out that a reserve system based on your sovereign debt as the reserve asset leads to a deindustrialization. And so their system, what they're trying to create is a system where they can use their own currency to buy commodities and stuff. But if you end up with a trade surplus with China, you can settle it out on the Shanghai Gold Exchange and get gold instead of Chinese sovereigns. I'm sure if you wanted to get some Chinese sovereigns, they'd be happy to sell them to you, but you need really think hard about that as a reserve manager because China's been known to pull the rug pull on those assets as well. So my own view is that gold just got ahead of itself, mm-hmm. probably is running a couple years hotter than it should be, and I'm expecting a long, you know, at least 18-month period of consolidation. Probably any prints below 3,500 are really buyable, and probably any prints above 4,200 are probably where you should ease up. I just kind of rough guess. I think 10 years out, you know, you're probably going to be closer to 10,000. You know, it just looks the way that the drift.
An analyst that you and I both follow works for a company that we both like, we buy research from, called Strategus, saw parallels between this and bull market in gold in 2006, which a lot of folks don't remember. But this long, long uptrend in gold actually started around 2001, down in the 200s, believe it or not.
I know.
But he noted a similar parabolic spike upwards in 2006, followed by about a 20% pullback, mm-hmm. and then a sideways action for about 6 months, that consolidation you talked about. Well, you know, we're off about 10% right now. 20% pullback would be about another 400, right at your $3,500 level, and a lot of sideways action. So I kind of expect, yeah, for, I don't know, 18 months might be a little long in my estimation, but I think somewhere in the mid 3,000s, we go sideways for a while, and, you know, see how the world changes during that time. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you. I think gold's long-term uptrend's pretty substantial. I would note that gold stocks can make a lot of money at $3,500. Gold mining companies, that is. All-in costs are sub 2,000 for most of the major mines, and they are quite profitable at these levels. Doesn't mean they're going to go up, because they usually track this gold, but yeah, the industry would be just fine with $3,500 gold for 18 months.
The fear of investors is that gold miners have been notoriously bad stewards of capital. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they should be able to make lots of good money. The odds are, how are they going to flitter it away?
What are they going to do with that? Well, you know, the same thing has been happening in the gold industry, which is a lot smaller than the oil and gas industry, where there's been a lot of capital allocation discipline come to that industry over the
years.
That's
correct.
Yeah. Shareholders have just kind of cracked the whip. Well, the same thing's been going on in the gold mining industry. It's just a lot less obvious because it's so much smaller.
Yeah.
But there's been much improved capital allocation. There's still people out there throwing money away in exploration that goes nowhere.
Yeah.
But I think the industry's in better shape than it's been in a while.
It's the nature of the business. Mm-hmm. Well, Mark, I think this is a pretty good place to close for today. As a reminder, if you want to submit a question, send one to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.